Welcome our students from New Holstein High School. Would the students please stand? Thank you very much. You may be seated. We invite students from all the high schools in Wisconsin to join us for an oral argument. This program is called Court with Class, and it's sponsored by the State Bar and this court. It is a national award-winning program, and we're very proud of it. And the New Holstein High School students are here with that program. They've received briefs about this case and may have done some work on the case. And at noon, they will discuss the procedures and processes of this court with one of the justices. You're all welcome to attend that session. It will be on the, as I said, processes, but not on the substantive issues raised in this case. And the justice who will handle that noon presentation today is Justice David Prosser. And Justice Prosser will, after the court is introduced, leave because he is not participating in this case. So let me introduce the court. On my far left is Justice Patience Rogensack. Seated next to her is the Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. The immediate right is Justice John Wilcox, and to his right is Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right, Justice Diane Sykes. With those introductions made, I will call our second and last case for the February arguments, 02-2035, Beloit Liquidating Trust versus Jeffrey T. Grade. And we have Paul Lynn arguing for the many of the defendants for 23 minutes. Mitchell Bryan, who will be introduced for 2 minutes. Curtis, is it Meshling? Neckling, who will also be introduced for 30 minutes, and Mr. Lynn, 5 in rebuttal. Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. If it pleases the court, I'm Paul Lynn. I represent defendants below, petitioners here in Chokey, Redinger, Messier, and Daffin. I've also been asked to speak on behalf of the other defendants for purposes of this argument. BLT's complaint tells a story of the last chapter of a 140-year-old Wisconsin company, Beloit Corporation. BLT alleges that faced with the loss of market share for paper machines, These paper machines are as big as football fields, due to foreign competition and on the verge of becoming unprofitable, a strategy was developed to expand into the Asian market with contracts for 4 of the world's largest and fastest paper machines ever built. Business people faced with those realities made business decisions to take business risks that appeared prudent at the time. With hindsight, they may appear to have been improvident. The hoped-for outcome of preserving 1,000 Wisconsin jobs and generating profits wasn't realized. The complaint alleges that because those business decisions didn't turn out as hoped, that these defendants, who were officers and directors, should have known from the beginning of each contract in 1996 that it would cost more than anticipated to manufacture the machines, that Beloit would lose money, that Beloit's customer, the largest paper company in Asia, would breach the contracts and go bankrupt without paying Beloit. The complaint alleges that the defendants should have known that Beloit was doomed in 1996 and was allegedly continuously insolvent from 1996, but for loans totaling $650 million from these same defendants at Beloit's parent company, Hernisch Fager, also based in Wisconsin.
Those loans from Harnish Fayo were corporate loans or individual loans?
Those were corporate loans.
Okay.
Despite Beloit's having weathered every manner of business cycle in its 140-year history, including the Depression and two world wars, BLT claims that from 1996 on, Beloit should have been operated not for the shareholders, not for the long haul, but for the benefit of its creditors, because during that time, with this crisis with these APP contracts, with this challenge of foreign competition, it was in the vicinity of insolvency. The BLT claims that the defendants breached fiduciary duties by entering those contracts in 1996.
What was known to the creditors at that time? In other words, what information did they have whether you were or were not insolvent? I'm talking about in 1994, 95, 96.
Well, the creditors are not a solid mass of people.
Yes.
For example, the complaint lists several creditors. One of them, Potlatch Corporation, was a customer of Beloit's based in Idaho, and Potlatch Corporation had a breach of contract claim.
I guess what I'm getting at, and this may not have been in there, but usually you have when you do business, you have a Dun and Bradstreet, and people kind of check on that and see what your credit ratings are. You being the, was there any problem with that?
Beloit's credit ratings, although it's not in the pleadings, rolled with the business cycles.
All right.
And Beloit was owned and operated as a subsidiary, owned 80% by Harnish Fager. Harnish Fager is a public company, then traded on the New York Stock Exchange, 10-Ks, 10-Qs, reports on a regular basis.
Okay. Thank you.
But the allegation is that the entering the APP contracts in 1996 was a breach of fiduciary duty, that failing to maintain adequate accounting so they could see that they were losing money on these contracts was a breach of fiduciary duty, that continuing the business after the creditors now say it should have been shuttered was a breach of fiduciary duty, and that failing to disclose the losses earlier than they did was a breach of fiduciary duty. Now, remember, the complaint says the contracts were entered into in 1996, in the summer, and then two more in the fall of 1996. The engineering, the work was begun to be undertaken on these contracts in that period and through 1997. By February of 1998, according to the complaint, and March of 1998, full disclosure was made of the losses. These are huge contracts. These are huge machines. This isn't a long period of time in the life of a contract for a machine to be built in Indonesia the size of a football field. BLT claims that the defendants breached their fiduciary duties despite repeated allegations beginning in paragraph 1 and 8 times thereafter that the defendants were engaging in the complaint of conduct in order to promote the interests of Beloit's shareholder. Officers and directors of a corporation owe a duty to the shareholder. Promoting the interests of the shareholder is not a breach of fiduciary duty.
Counselor, let me interrupt you a little bit. When I looked at how the trial court analyzed this, the trial court looked at two claimants on behalf of which the creditors' committee was operating. One claimant being the debtor, Beloit Corporation, and the other being the unsecured creditors that had filed in the bankruptcy case and hadn't been paid in full. And it had analyzed them separately because of the way in which a director relates to a corporation for the benefit of the corporation's health and the shareholders' benefit. And then it analyzed them in the way in which a director of a corporation relates to creditors that are unsecured of the corporation. You didn't argue that, essentially, to us. And as I analyzed it, I thought it was helpful. Can you tell me why you discounted that argument?
Well, Your Honor, I haven't discounted that argument. I think our briefs begin with the need to unbundle this and to credit Judge Dugan for unbundling the claim. There are indeed two sets of claims here. The claims of the assigning creditors of Beloit Corporation, and they're listed in paragraph 7 of the complaint. They include Potlatch and several other companies whose name slipped my mind right now. And the other are claims assigned to the liquidating trust pursuant to the plan of the bankruptcy plan. They are the claims of Beloit Corporation itself. And Judge Dugan properly isolated those claims and determined that they're time barred on the one hand, simple application of the statute of limitations to dates in the complaint, and on the other hand, the claim that there's a duty to creditors is inconsistent with the allegations that the company is making its product, that the company is out there selling its product because it is a going concern. They're inconsistent with the allegations that people are lending the company $650 million. One wouldn't lend $650 million to a company unless one thought it was a going concern. And it is important to see the two sets of claims. Judge Dugan did. I don't think the Court of Appeals looked at that, differentiated those claims at all.
No, and where I want you to address it, because where I found it helpful was trying to look at the application of 11 U.S. Code Section 108A. And in both of the briefs, both yours and your opponent's briefs, you tend to use the cases in a general way. And, of course, it's difficult because we don't have a Supreme Court case that's on point that tells us exactly when the trustee can assert claims and whose claims can the trustee assert. And if he asserts several claims, do they stand on different footing? So I'd like you to tell me, if we look simply at the claims of the creditor, not the claims that are made on behalf of the injury to the corporation itself, how does that affect Section 108A?
Section 108A does not apply at all to the claims assigned by the creditors.
Why?
Because Section 108A provides for a tolling of the statute of limitations. If the statute hasn't already expired, which is why you need that adverse domination doctrine to fill the gap. But we'll talk about that later.
Right.
Section 108A applies to toll the statute of limitations on claims brought by a trustee. And incidentally, the Beloit Liquidating Trust is nothing in the world like that kind of trustee. They've never argued they are.
I understand that, but there's the agency theory that they're the agent of the trustee, and there are cases that say the agent of the trustee can operate with the authority of the trust. So
in this bankruptcy, there was never a trustee appointed. Had, for example, had the creditors felt that the debtor in possession, and there was never a trustee appointed, the operations of Beloit and of Harnischweger were left in the hands of the debtor in possession. Had the creditors felt that the debtor in possession was wasting an asset, for example, wasting this claim, they could have gone to the bankruptcy court under Section 1104 and asked for the appointment of a trustee for cause on gross mismanagement, or simply upon a showing that the appointment of a trustee would have been in the best interest of the creditor. They did not do so. There's nothing in the record as to why they did or didn't do so. They didn't do so. Had they done so, there would have been a trustee who could have relied on Section 108A. They didn't. There wasn't a trustee.
Okay, well, I want you to pretend that this creditors committee is an agent of the trustee, just because I want to look at that argument. And if it were, could it use this statute to extend the statute of limitations on behalf of the unsecured creditors?
I don't think the U.S. Supreme Court would say they could. If you read the Henhouse case, the Hartford Underwriters case, if you read a case called Lamey versus United States Trustee, which is a slip opinion right now, they are very, very strict on interpreting the bankruptcy code. The whole bankruptcy system is purely a creature of statute. These aren't Article III courts with inherent equitable powers. They get the power that Congress has given them. And if Congress wanted to say a creditors committee acting as an agent for someone or on its own or assigned by a bankruptcy court or otherwise could benefit from the tolling of 108A, Congress would know how to say so. If you read the Hartford case, I think you'll think that that's how the Supreme Court's going to come out. Now, this is a close decision with courts below. There's a certain resistance to the harshness of the rule. We had Judge Dugan and Judge Wiedemeyer finding that the statute should be narrowly construed. We had Judge Fine and Judge Schutzen finding it shouldn't. We have a 2-to-1 split in the Cybergenics case, which really isn't about the abrogation of state law, so it's not as hard a case. The first time it goes around, we have a 6-5 split. The second time it goes around, en banc. But I think that if we start with the Supreme Court's position on this very, very narrow construction of the bankruptcy code, combine that with we're construing something that would abrogate state law, abrogate a state statute of limitations, those two policies dictate that there be no expansion by the courts of the language of Section 108A.
But what's the purpose of Section 108A? Why is it there in the bankruptcy code?
It is there to give during the pendency of the bankruptcy the debtor in possession or the trustee who has been appointed under 1104 the ability to take a little longer in bringing claims. Now, in this case, the bankruptcy was over. The plan was confirmed before even the creditors committee got an order authorizing the commencement of this lawsuit. They don't fit into 104. But they don't even get to 104 unless you first give them some kind of adverse domination, some kind of tolling of the statute of limitations, because they're complaining about events that occurred by their own pleading in 1996. The two-year statute applies 2 years later is 1998. The bankruptcy hasn't started yet. It didn't start till June of 99. The claims are already time-barred. The claims have to be alive when the bankruptcy starts for 108A to apply at all, even if you were a trustee.
Thank you.
If you apply the 2-year statute of limitations, if you apply the 6-year statute of limitations, it's still alive.
If you apply the 6-year statute of limitations, the statute of limitations does not bar the claims, but you don't have breach of fiduciary duty claims. They require intentional conduct. Wisconsin statute section 180.0828 on director liability requires intentional conduct. The case of Rigott versus Page requires intentional conduct. So if you want the negligence statute, fine, they're not time barred. They fail to state a claim on which relief may be granted under the prevailing substantive law. I'd like to turn to the issue of fiduciary duty. If the court wants to hear about the choice of law issue, I'd be glad to talk about it. I think that 180.1704 disposes of it. I think that the pleading that the primary place of business of Beloit Corporation was in Wisconsin. I think counsel's letter to Judge Dugan saying that acts complained up here, the focal point of the acts complained up here were in Milwaukee County. I think the choice of law question is easy to answer. Wisconsin hasn't adopted internal affairs. The creditors' rights are not internal affairs of the corporation. But the BLT doesn't want this court to apply Wisconsin law because under Wisconsin law, BLT's complaint fails to state a claim on behalf of the creditors. The complaint alleges clearly that Beloit remained a going concern, that defendants were responding to intense foreign competition by selling the machines in Asia. They're still in business. They're still looking to the future. That defendants were acting for the benefit of Beloit's shareholder, Harnischweger. There are 8 allegations that they're acting for the benefit of the shareholders. Under McGivern, under Boyd, there's a fiduciary duty to act for the benefit of shareholders. That defendants loaned the company or caused Harnischweger to loan Beloit $650 million. No rational corporation, no rational business person would loan $650 million to a business they thought wasn't a going concern. And incidentally, no rational crook, and there's a suggestion that these guys are bad guys, would be loaning $650 million to Beloit in order to cheat its creditors. You know, this is not Enron, this is not Tyco, this is not people pulling money out of Beloit, this is people looking for the long haul for a company that's been around for 140 years, putting $650 million into Beloit. And that's in the complaint. And you take it as true, and it prohibits anybody from thinking this isn't a going concern. Over and over again, we see that they're acting for the company. Under McGivern, there's no fiduciary duty to creditors as long as the company is a going concern. They owed their duty to Beloit and its shareholders. Now, a fiduciary duty is the obligation to act in the best interest of another party. The fiduciary, the director, the officer, accepts this position of trust and is asked to manage the investment, the shareholders' investment. Harnischweiger's investment in Beloit is the investment we're talking about. They're representing the shareholder, Harnischweiger, and managing its investment in the assets of Beloit, and they are entrusted to exercise the fiduciary duty to exercise their discretion and expertise. And faced with this unrelenting foreign pressure, they choose to go into these APP contracts. In hindsight, that decision may now appear to be improvident, but those charged with running the company at the time had to do something about foreign competition, and they made a choice that they thought was prudent. The business judgment rule that we read about in Riggett protects that decision from second-guessing 6 years after the decision was made, especially here where the complaint alleges that the decision was made for the benefit of shareholders, for the benefit of Harnischweiger. So for as long as Beloit was a going concern under the McGivern decision, defendants didn't owe any duty to creditors. Mind you, they couldn't defraud the creditors, but in front of Judge Dugan, counsel for the BLT said, this is not a fraud case. We are not alleging Beloit was defrauded. That's at page 76 of the transcript. As long as Beloit remained a going concern, they had a duty to act in the best interest of Beloit and its shareholder, Harnischweiger, and, although it's not in the record, Mitsubishi.
How did they carry those loans? I mean, I'm just I know that money was loaned from Harnischweiger that owned 80% of the corporation, but how did Beloit how were they noticed on their books?
The complaint doesn't tell us, and sitting here right now, I don't know.
All right. Perhaps the question, and maybe I'm – there was some question about the true financial capacity of what was happening in Beloit, and that was a difficulty. Now, were these loans known? I'm talking about the –
The money coming from Harnischweiger,
the
relationship between Harnischweiger and Beloit is disclosed in Harnischweiger's financial statements, which are filed with the SEC.
Okay, thank you.
But you know, on this fiduciary duty issue, and I think this is perhaps one of the most important issues before the court today, mere technical insolvency, despite going concern status, should not be the shifting point for fiduciary duties. It would be an unworkable disaster to impose such a standard, especially for a cyclical business like Beloit or a cyclical business like Harnischweiger. Week to week, quarter to quarter, the fiduciary duty would shift from shareholders to creditors and back and forth, and that after a bad month, directors would be faced with suits by creditors saying they didn't act in the creditors' interest. Shareholders could sue them the next month saying they didn't act in the shareholders' interest. There would be endless conflict. The floodgates of litigation would be opened wide, and there would be opportunity to ask courts over and over again to second-guess the business decisions of officers and directors.
What's insolvency? Assets less than liabilities?
That's one of the tests for insolvency.
What are the other tests?
I think that's the test that Wisconsin applies. And on rebuttal, I'll be able to answer that question. I can't answer it
right
now.
I understand that. Go ahead.
And the point...
Well, they were insolvent. I assume their liabilities exceeded their assets.
Well, the complaint says they were insolvent but for the $650 million of loans from Harnischweiger.
Yeah, but that's a liability.
We have to take that as true. We have to take it as true.
Breach of fiduciary duty is a tort, is it not?
Breach of fiduciary duty is a tort. The Warmka case says it's a tort. And creditors don't need any more help. They don't need tort law. They don't need this extra protection of fiduciary duty. They can say, we're not going to do business with you unless you pay us first. They can say, give us some collateral, give us a security interest. They can charge higher interest. They cannot do business. They can decide not to extend credit.
Creditors are contract partners vis-a-vis the corporation.
They are contract partners, arm's length. Arm's length, a bargain. They make a bargain. Here's how we'll extend credit. Here's how we'll sell you a product. Here's the terms on which you'll pay for it. There's a risk. If you go broke, we don't get paid.
Ordinarily confined to contract remedies.
Contract remedies are the way to go with it, because the contract remedies, if there's a business failure, and the bankruptcy law remedies and the fraudulent transfer remedies are there to protect creditors. They don't need the additional, you've got to act in our best interest. The bankruptcy courts will protect creditors from preferences given to shareholders when the company's about to go under. The law against fraudulent transfers, Wisconsin's Chapter 242, will protect creditors from assets being dissipated without receiving fair value in exchange. Creditors have plenty of protection. There's no need for the court to depart from its past rendition of this and impose a fiduciary duty to creditors upon a going concern.
Counsel, isn't the linchpin the choice of law question? Because unless you get it makes a difference if you get Wisconsin law or Delaware law. So isn't that where the emphasis should be placed in this case? I mean, Delaware law is different than Wisconsin law with regard to what's necessary for insolvency, arguably.
Delaware law is a vicinity insolvency state. Wisconsin is a going concern state. And because of that, the court needs to do a choice of law analysis, because there's a difference in law. There's a conflict. The plaintiff came to Wisconsin to file its lawsuit. Wisconsin has a statute, 180.1704, that says Chapter 180, the Wisconsin Business Corporation Law, applies to businesses that do business in this state. The complaint alleges that the primary place of business of Beloit Corporation was in Wisconsin, and I think everybody knows
that. The counter to that is that it's a Delaware corporation, the bankruptcy is in Delaware.
Well, the bankruptcy is an appeal to federal law. It's going to be federal bankruptcy law applied. That's not the fact that the bankruptcy court sits in Delaware is not taking advantage of Delaware law. It's still federal bankruptcy law. And the fact that the bankruptcy venue statutes allow a company to bring their bankruptcy either where the principal place of business is, and there's a letter to the Court of Appeals explaining how it could have been brought in the Western District of Wisconsin, but they're also allowed to bring their bankruptcy where they're incorporated. But other than being incorporated in Delaware, and incorporated in Delaware quite some time ago for matters apparently of convenience, there are no contacts related to this case with Delaware, and indeed counsel represented to Judge Dugan that the Milwaukee County served as the focal point for the acts and omissions at issue here.
Is that the letter, the venue letter that you're talking about?
The venue letter to Judge Dugan. My time is up. If there are any more questions, I'll be happy to answer them or do it in rebuttal.
Thank you. Mr. Lynn. Brian, you have 2 minutes representing Thomas E. Engelsman.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Good morning. Attorney Gregory Katsonis, appearing on the petitioner, Thomas Engelsman, would like to introduce Mitch Bryan of Chicago, Illinois, law firm Levenfield & Perlstein, to the court.
Thank you. This is a pro hoc vici appearance, counsel.
Yes, it is.
You may proceed.
Thank
Welcome
you.
To Wisconsin.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I will be addressing the question of issue preclusion that the Court asked the parties to address. This Court must have been as puzzled as the defendants were to see that the appellate court had reversed the trial court based on the theory of issue preclusion, which BLT never raised in the trial court, didn't even attempt to raise on appeal. Quoting State v. Rogers, and it's long been Wisconsin law, the appellate must articulate each of its theories to the trial court to preserve its right to appeal. Raising issue preclusion sua sponte was error. There's one single narrow exception, which is inapplicable here, for pro se prisoner appeals, where the court has discretion. There was no discretion here in the appellate court. And even if the appellate court had discretion, the appellate court never gave defendants an opportunity to brief or argue the issue. Had they done so, the defendants would have pointed out to the appellate court that the appellate court simply missed the express provision in the June 7, 2001 order that expressly reserved all defenses. The statute of limitations argument, of course, is a defense. Even if issue preclusion could have been considered, the reason that BLT didn't assert it here is that there was no plausible reason to do it. Issue preclusion exists only if the issue involved has actually been litigated below or in the prior proceeding, and even if it has, that applying it has to comport with due process, and assuming it comports with due process, must meet the criteria of the fundamental fairness test. Number one, the issue of Section 108A was not addressed in the bankruptcy court. That's apparent from the reservation in Section 3 or Paragraph 3 of the June 5th order, giving the creditors committee permission to sue. And it's also apparent from the very language of the order itself that says that Section 108A, and this is not in the order itself, this is simply in an introductory recital, that section, the tolling provisions of Section 108A arguably may apply. It was a matter of background and not a matter before the court in any material allegation or statement or finding in the order that BLT itself drafted and proposed to the court. In respect to due process.
You have just a couple of moments. Move quickly, please.
Due process requires that there must be an identity of interest with the parties involved in the prior proceeding. The only thing the Court of Appeals focused on, based on judicial notice, was an inference that there was a close alignment between the debtor in possession and all the defendants. There was no close alignment. The interests had already diverged, and in particular, with respect to defendant Tom Engelsman, he had been out of Beloit Corporation since February of 1998, 16 months before the bankruptcy was filed, more than 2 years before the motion for permission to sue was filed. He had an acrimonious post-termination relationship with the corporation. There was no love lost between them. There is no conceivable basis, the debtor in possession or anybody involved in arranging for the terms of the order entered was looking out for his interest, nor the interest of any of the other defendants. I'll conclude. I know my time is up.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your pro hoc vici authority is now expired. Counsel?
May it please the Court, I am John Hovel, and I am honored to introduce Kurt Meckling, who will handle the argument on behalf of Beloit Liquidating Trust.
And he is a lawyer licensed in New York?
In the state of New York, Your Honor, yes.
Okay, thank you, counsel. Your motion also will be granted, and you appear pro hoc vici.
May it please the Court, my name is Kurt Meckling, and with Mr. Hovel here, I represent Beloit Liquidating Trust and by extension, the thousands of creditors who are the beneficiaries of Beloit Liquidating Trust. I understand Mr. Lin's desire to throw up the business judgment rule and to attempt to get to the merits of his case and to say that on the merits we lose. I'm happy to address those issues at the right day and right place, but that is not what this appeal is about. This appeal is about whether Section 108A applied to extend all applicable statutes of limitations, whether the 2-year statute or the 6-year statute, whether the committee taking over on behalf of Beloit when Beloit refused to sue had the benefit of, first of all, the standing to sue, which the bankruptcy court conferred, and the benefit of Section 108A, which the bankruptcy court says in its order arguably could expire, and therefore we want you, committee, to bring this lawsuit. This appeal is about whose law governs on an issue that is central to the relationship between a corporation and its shareholders, the corporation and its officers and directors, the corporation and its creditors.
Counselor, hasn't the relationship between the corporation and the shareholders already been sued to judgment? I thought there was a derivative action in the Eastern District of Wisconsin where a $10 million judgment was entered on behalf of the shareholders.
Your Honor, that did not involve Beloit. That was a lawsuit brought by Harnischweiger shareholders, because Harnischweiger shareholders Harnischweiger was a publicly traded company. Beloit was a privately held company controlled by Harnischweiger.
But isn't it Beloit's losses and the lack of disclosure of those losses that were alleged to cause folks to buy shares in Harnischer they wouldn't have bought had they known about these losses that you're complaining of?
Justice Wilcox asked the question, what did the creditors know? When did they know about the insolvency? Remember, the issue here is not what shareholders' rights are at Harnischweiger. The issue here is, what are the creditors?
I understand that, and I brought you to that question because you're the one that was telling me this lawsuit was about shareholders' rights, and I didn't think it was.
Well, what I'm going to is that under the internal affairs doctrine, universally adopted, the rights as between a corporation, its shareholders, and its creditors are governed by the law of the state of incorporation. Justice Wilcox asked, well, when did the creditors here know that there was something wrong? The fact of the matter is that there was no disclosure that Beloit was insolvent or even in the vicinity of insolvency until the bankruptcy on June 5, 1999.
That's not what your complaint says. Your complaint says in February of 1998 the disclosure was first made.
The disclosure that was made was that there was a $50 million cost overrun. There was no disclosure of insolvency. What the complaint says is that that wasn't even the tip of the iceberg. What the complaint says is that these disastrous contracts in Indonesia by themselves resulted in total losses. I think the contract price was $580 million. Over and above that, they lost over $400 million. And it wasn't until the company went into bankruptcy that the insolvency was disclosed.
You read the financial statements of Harnischweiger that are publicly filed as a public corporation and looked at its subsidiary. You mean you couldn't tell me that they had significant debts in the subsidiary from those filings?
That was not disclosed.
Not the cost overruns, nothing, that they were... Well, what were you...
As the complaint alleges, the full story didn't come out until after the bankruptcy. And
where was the disclosure of February 1998 made?
There was a disclosure in a press release and in quarterly reports that there had been a $50 million cost overrun that should have been recorded in earlier dates. The point is that Delaware law does apply to the relationship between...
But don't we apply Wisconsin choice of law principles when we're deciding which law applies?
That is correct. And I believe that the court should take this opportunity to join the chorus of all the other states which have said, and like the United States Supreme Court has said, that the internal affairs doctrine does apply the state of incorporations law to lawsuits like this, which go to the fiduciary duties of officers and directors.
And we have a whole body of law on choice of law, and you start out by finding whether employing the law of the other state, here Delaware, would be intermeddling in the affairs of Wisconsin, and the reasons for that. And when I look back at the letter that was filed for venue with the trial court, it seems at that point in time there was an absolute agreement that all of the creditors' concerns arose in Wisconsin. These were Wisconsin-originated contracts, that the only contact with Delaware was incorporation. And, of course, later on they chose that forum for bankruptcy. I don't know, maybe they think our bankruptcy court moves too fast or too slow or whatever, but the law is the same. So I think we have to apply the law that we have, and applying the law that we have, how would you evaluate the five factors and whether or not this is officious intermeddling, given Chapter 180 of the Wisconsin law, which basically sets the standards for directors of all corporations, including foreign corporations, when they're doing business in Wisconsin?
Applying the pertinent choice of law rules here in Wisconsin, predictability. Predictability weighs overwhelmingly in favor of Delaware's law because Beloit wasn't a Wisconsin-only operation. Far from it. It operated, and it's pleaded in the complaint, not only nationwide but internationally. Its creditors were all over the country. Its creditors were all over the world. And if you are to have predictability, you have to know what one state's law is going to govern. Beloit itself chose which law it wanted to govern its relationships vis-a-vis its officers, directors, shareholders, and creditors when it deliberately incorporated in Delaware. And that wasn't just a matter of convenience. Major corporations incorporate in Delaware for the well-known reason, among others, well, two. First, it's generally perceived that Delaware law is more favorable to officers and directors. And second, Delaware has a very well-established and well-settled body of corporate law, so people have certainty. So creditors know what they're getting into. So shareholders know what they're getting into.
If this is a breach of contract action and the contract originated in Wisconsin, don't you have to apply Wisconsin law to it?
But it is not a breach of contract action. And I think that counsel's reference to Chapter 180, the business corporations law here in Wisconsin, really cuts against them, because at 180.0747, it says that Wisconsin defers to the law of the state of incorporation for derivative lawsuits.
But this isn't a derivative lawsuit.
Yes, it is. Yes,
how
it is.
So? The shareholders are not people that are being represented by the creditors' committee. It's unsecured creditors.
The committee sues in a derivative capacity. The committee went to the bankruptcy court for permission to sue in a derivative capacity because we had asked Beloit to commence the litigation, and not surprisingly, Beloit and its parent, Harnischfeger, said, no, we won't. And so Judge Walsh conferred upon the creditors committee the right, the standing, to stand just as a shareholder would in a derivative case.
Well, but isn't this a little bit of a different kind of use of the word derivative? Generally, a derivative action is an action where the injury is to the corporation itself. The creditors' claims are not necessarily injury to the corporation, but really to those creditors that were not paid. And because the debtor in possession could have brought the suit on behalf of the creditors and chose not to, I can see that his authority might be derivative, but I'm not sure that it's a derivative lawsuit in the matter in which you're characterizing.
With respect, the complaint pleads derivative claims on behalf of Beloit for injury to Beloit, for losses of hundreds of millions of dollars. The ultimate beneficiaries of any recovery may be the creditors under the terms of the trust.
Right, and I agree with that characterization, which is why I asked opposing counsel about the two different claims. In my mind, the claims stand on very different footing, counselor, whether you're arguing a creditor's claim or whether you're arguing a claim on behalf of an injury to the corporation, the debtor that went through bankruptcy. And I don't know if you agree with that or not, but you seem now to be dividing the claims.
There are two sets of claims, but I don't agree that they set, that they rest on different footing.
Why is that?
That's because there is a fiduciary duty that is owed both to the corporation by its officers and directors, fiduciary duty of care, fiduciary duty of loyalty, a duty not to engage in corporate waste, which it owes to the corporation, and what makes this case a little bit different, when the corporation is insolvent or in the vicinity of insolvency, then, too, there is the same sort of fiduciary relationship to the creditors for the obvious reason that at that point, when the equity is gone and when the company is in the vicinity of insolvency, they're playing with the creditors' money. Clearly, Delaware law says that there is such a duty to creditors, and it arises when the company is even in the vicinity of insolvency. I submit, for the reasons stated in our briefs and earlier, that under the Internal Affairs Doctrine, Delaware law should govern these claims and govern the extent of that fiduciary duty.
But does even the Internal Affairs law apply to third parties like creditors, or does it just apply to shareholders?
It applies to creditors when the company is insolvent.
What's your authority for that?
My authority for that is the Geyer case in Delaware, the Pierres case cited to the court in our brief, which is, I think, the most recent and most thoroughgoing discussion of fiduciary duties of officers and directors of an insolvent Delaware company to its creditors. And
now, I was looking back at the Internal Affairs Doctrine. I guess that's what I was looking at. But thank you. I'll reread those.
Yeah. And I submit further that there is no conflict here between the Delaware standard and the Wisconsin standard, because this court and federal courts interpreting its jurisprudence in the Molloy case, the Hinz case, the Schmitz case, have said that the duty arises when the company, and I'm quoting now from the Molloy case, when the corporation ceases to be a going institution or its business is in such shape that its directors know or ought to know that suspension is impending. And common sense tells you that
what case is that where you have the or that you just read?
Yes, that is, I'm quoting from Molloy v. Korf, 352 F. Sup. 569.
Okay, that's not a Wisconsin case.
Which quotes from Hinz v. Van Dusen, 95 Wisconsin, 503-508. And my point is that common sense tells you that that must be the rule. Because if Mr.
Lynn... So you don't agree with the McGivern and?
Pardon me?
McGivern has an and.
I think that it's not a conjunctive and, it's a disjunctive and. And I think...
Should have used or then.
If Mr. Lynn is right that Wisconsin doesn't recognize a fiduciary duty to creditors until there's no more money left and the company ceases to be a going concern, that strips all the meaning from the fiduciary duty. Justice Sykes asked, well, gee, normally aren't the duties to creditors governed by contract? And the answer to that is yes, normally, but not in the case of an insolvency. Jurisdictions around the country, including Wisconsin, have recognized that when a company is in insolvency or in the vicinity of insolvency, there's a new player at the table, somebody else whose interests have to be protected, and that is the creditors. The fiduciary duty reaches out to them.
Well, what about Mr. Lynn's argument that that means 1 month they're insolvent and the duty is to creditors, the next quarter they're solvent, and the duty is to the shareholders?
The fact of the matter is that if a company is insolvent or in the vicinity of insolvency, even if it's not insolvent, even if it's in the vicinity of insolvency, there is a fiduciary duty because creditors' money is at risk.
But isn't that, just following up on the Chief's question, if that's the case, and I know that opposing counsel raised that, that is going to be, that is a very tough standard, and you're going to have people in court. He talks about the cascade of lawsuits or opening the door. I would be concerned about if there's an assumption that who knows for sure whether you are, you know, what point do you delineate that? Insolvency is not something that is particularly when you're dealing with, I won't say $1 billion Asian pulp and paper. Was there an assumption that they were going to be insolvent or the Fitchburg? You don't know those things, whether they're, I'm talking about when you're dealing. If you have a contract to deliver a machine and then you deliver the machine and that entity goes down the tubes, that's something that there are some entrepreneurial risks or something like that. So how do you judge this or about to go insolvent? How do you judge that? Where is that line?
The line is where the corporation or its officers and directors know or should know that there is a significant risk that they will not be able to meet their obligations. And the courts across the country have addressed this issue as to, you know, what constitutes insolvency. And they've enunciated various tests. And I agree with you, Justice. You know, it can be a complicated question, but it's an issue of fact. It's not an issue to be disposed of at the pleading stage before there's been the least bit of discovery.
Only if we choose Delaware law would we have to address that, correct? Because that isn't our Wisconsin standard.
I respectfully disagree. We believe that there is no distinction and can be no distinction between Wisconsin and Delaware law.
Counsel, following up on Justice Wilcox's question, and that dealt with the floodgates of litigation that your opposing counsel refers to, if you have this vicinity of insolvency test. And I'm always, in response to this floodgate of litigation argument, it concerns me, and I think it concerns the other justices, because we don't want that kind of instability or, you know, doom, despair, and agony. But, you know, last I looked, Delaware was still operating. So how is it playing out? I mean, is there this floodgate of litigation on the issue of vicinity? I mean, vicinity, just like Justice Wilcox said, seems to me to be pretty relative. I might be in your neighborhood, but you might not think I'm in your neighbor. You know, it's all relative. So how can what sounds like such an amorphous test give the kind of stability that you need in business relations?
As Your Honor observed, Delaware is still up and running, and Delaware is still the capital of incorporation in the United States. And there has not been this flood of litigation. This is an issue which the body of law on this is relatively discreet. And I think most of the cases where courts have addressed the fiduciary duty of faithless officers and directors to creditors of an insolvent company are cited in our brief. I mean, there are 10 or 12 cases. And we are doing exactly here what the court in the Third Circuit said in Cybergenics. A creditors committee should and must be allowed to do that when the officers and directors of a company are accused of wrongdoing, and the debtor refuses to bring that lawsuit. For the benefit of creditors, the committee has to step up to the plate and bring that derivative lawsuit. Clearly, the federal courts across the board have recognized that that is part and parcel of the power of the bankruptcy court to give that authority to creditors' committees to enforce the interests of bankrupt companies and the interests of their creditors by bringing lawsuits where The debtor doesn't want to sue. And that's exactly what we had to do here. We had to go to the bankruptcy court to get permission to bring this lawsuit. Why? Because, as is recognized in Judge Walsh's authorization order, arguably, he says, the 108A extension of statute of limitations may be expiring. And so we have to enter this now, before the plan becomes effective and because the debtor has refused to sue. If you look at the record of the bankruptcy court, it becomes readily apparent that central to the entire Beloit plan was the maintenance and the pursuit of these claims. These were claims that were identified by the committee. The company refused to sue, and in the plan of reorganization and in the settlement agreement between the various creditor bodies, in the authorization order, in the confirmation order, these claims were preserved so on the effective date of the plan, they could be transferred to the Beloit Liquidating Trust, but they had to be started.
Counselor, why was there a limitation on the damages that you could get if you're proceeding on behalf of the bankruptcy estate and limited to the insurance coverage these folks might have?
That goes to exactly the point I was making, that these claims and the way they were going to be handled was central to the entire reorganization, and the limitation on damages was part of the deal that was made that permitted Harnisch-Fager to emerge from bankruptcy rather than have continuing litigation by the Beloit estate against the Harnisch-Fager estate. And so the settlement agreement was entered into, which, as you note, limits the recovery to insurance proceeds. The court issued its proposed plan of reorganization, which specifically preserved these rights. Interestingly, I think it was Mrs. Grade and Corby at first objected to that and then for some reason withdrew their objection. They could have litigated it there. They didn't. Then the court issued its confirmation order, which specifically, again, preserved these rights to the liquidating trust. And then to preserve the statute of limitations extension under 108A, Justice Walsh issued his authorization order on June 5 of 2001, and this lawsuit was brought that day or the following day. I'd like to go to the issue of the applicable statute of limitations. We submit that, as Judge Dugan himself said on the record, if 108A applies, then the claims of Beloit clearly are not time-barred, and that was what the court below found. It was only because Judge Dugan could find that 108A didn't apply to any of the claims here that he was able to get around the extension of the statute of limitations. I respectfully submit that the claims pleaded in this complaint, not as recharacterized by defendants, but as pleaded in the complaint, are claims that sound in neglect, in failure to perform duty, in non-action. We repeatedly plead that these defendants, and I'm quoting from our complaint, acted negligently, recklessly, and irresponsibly. More important, or equally important, that they also failed to take action, that when the errors, the consequences of their huge negligence began to come home to roost, that they didn't take the actions that a responsible officer and director should have taken to preserve the assets of the corporation for the benefit of the corporation and, at that point, for the benefit of its creditors, given that the company was insolvent or in the vicinity.
What do you think is the correct statute of limitations under Wisconsin substantive law for the breach of fiduciary duty claim?
As for these breaches of fiduciary duty claims, the 6-year statute under 893.53.
And why is that?
Because these are not intentional torts.
You don't think that they intentionally entered into those contracts?
Your Honor, I can intentionally drive my car down the street and unintentionally, negligently hit somebody.
Well, you're saying that this was negligent conduct, not intentional conduct, right?
We have alleged repeatedly that it was negligent, reckless, irresponsible, and furthermore, that there were failures to act, that there were failures to preserve the assets.
And were those negligent failures as well?
Yes.
Okay. Well, how do you get around the business judgment rule, then, if the corporation's directors are to be held liable for negligently made business decisions? How do you get around the Wisconsin's business judgment rule, which said we only hold them liable when they intentionally don't fulfill their obligations?
The statute I believe you refer to only refers to the liability of directors. It does not speak to the liability of officers. Each one of these defendants was an officer of Beloit and is sued in that capacity. And, in fact, I believe that that statute really cuts against them because it says, okay, we, the Wisconsin legislature, are prepared to provide some protection to directors who may or may not be actively involved in the day-to-day operations of the company. But for officers, there's no such, you know.
How about Regent versus Page? Doesn't it apply that to officers as well as directors?
We have pleaded in our complaint irresponsible and reckless conduct that is outside of the business judgment rule. Further, and this is critical, we've pleaded failures to act. Failures to act are not protected by the business judgment rule. And here, at a time when they should have seen the handwriting on the wall and done everything within their power to protect the creditors and the corporation, they did nothing. They didn't terminate the contracts. They didn't contract the business. There was an article, we haven't cited it, I just came across it a couple of days ago, but I believe that the dean of the Wisconsin Law School in a 2000 issue of the Wisconsin Law Review talking about the business judgment rule, in which he specifically acknowledges that, you know, business judgment rule doesn't protect non-action.
Counselor, I want to get you off of that because I see your yellow light is on, and
yes.
I need to hear what you think about whether the Court of Appeals committed error when it applied issue preclusion to the ability of the appellants to raise Section 108 as a bar to some of the claims?
Your Honor, we think that it did not. First, I should emphasize that the Court didn't have to get to issue preclusion to come to the decision that it made.
Right.
But the contention by these defendants that there is something unfair, unconstitutional, whatever adjective you want to pick, about what was done is simply insupportable.
Counselor, what kind of decision-making is involved when issue preclusion is applied to a particular case? Is it a decision-making done as a matter of law? Is it decision-making done in under a discretionary standard? Is it some combination? What's the standard?
I believe that it is a matter of law that the Court can itself pick up on where the record so supports it, and the record here did, and that's what the Court below found. It found that there is an identity of interest of these defendants. They're all being sued for engaging in the same conduct with each other. As we showed, these defendants, or at least most of them, were actually parties to the bankruptcy proceeding, putting claims, Mr. Grade and Mr. Corby actually objected to the plan on the grounds that it reserved these rights to sue them and then for whatever reasons withdrew that. And I think that Mr. Engelsman's counsel has been put forward to speak to this issue because arguably Mr. Engelsman is the only defendant who was not an active party on notice in the bankruptcy proceedings. I don't know whether that's true or not, but
Doesn't issue preclusion require that an issue actually be litigated? And was it ever litigated in the bankruptcy court about whether or not Section 108 could be raised as a defense?
Yes, it was. We made a motion. It was a contested matter. We made a motion in the bankruptcy court that said, here's what we found. Here are these claims that we believe are colorable claims. Judge Walsh, we're concerned that 108 is going to expire, and Beloit has refused to bring this lawsuit. Beloit came in and said, we don't think that the claims should be brought, but they didn't file a formal objection. But there was a contested matter. It had to be brought on by a contested matter because interested parties had to have an opportunity to hear, to a hearing, and that's what was done. So, yes.
But is this issue necessary to the judge's decision? I think that the decision that I read, the order that I read, said that 108 sub A may arguably apply. I don't know that that's necessary to letting you folks proceed on your claims, whether it applies or not.
It was a grounds for his decision, and he says it will arguably expire, not that it may arguably apply.
Okay.
That again goes back to my fundamental theme that preserving these claims for the benefit of Beloit and for the benefit of its creditors was the sine qua non of this bankruptcy. It's what is reflected in the plan, in the confirmation order, in the authorization order, in the trust agreement administered by the trust. And what is going on here is not such a mysterious decision, strategic decision, by these defendants who had an opportunity to appear in Judge Walsh's courtroom and object to say, no, we'll come to Wisconsin and ask the Wisconsin courts to second-guess the bankruptcy court. I believe that that is inappropriate. I believe for all the reasons we've stated that 108 extends all the applicable statute of limitations. I believe Delaware law applies. I believe that Wisconsin law on the fiduciary duty to creditors is the same or fundamentally the same. And hence, I respectfully submit that the decision below should be affirmed. And one last factual observation, Mr. Hovell reminds me, as is pleaded in the complaint, to the extent there's a question in the court's mind about, should Wisconsin law really, govern these duties because of the company's presence in Wisconsin? The complaint pleads that during the operative period, the corporate headquarters of Beloit were in Illinois, not in Wisconsin. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And your pro hoc vici status also ends. Mr. Lynn.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to address a few of the points raised by counsel. Justice Rogensack, you asked about whether this was a derivative action. I think, as we've tried to do all along, we should go to the pleadings. And the pleadings in paragraph 3 say that the Beloit Liquidating Trust and the claims of Beloit were assumed by the Beloit Liquidating Trust created under the plan. That's not derivative standing. That's an assumption, an assignment pursuant to a plan. The creditors' claims in paragraph 7 are also alleged, and we take those allegations as true, to have been assigned.
What difference does it make?
Well, the direction of the argument was going to whether the Wisconsin statute regarding derivative actions and derivative actions being governed by the law of the state of incorporation in contradistinction to 1704, which has everything else governed by Wisconsin law, for a business that does business in Wisconsin was the issue, and this is not a derivative action. Justice Abramson, you asked about the test for insolvency. The other test is the ability to pay debts as they become due. The complaint alleges that Beloit wasn't able to pay debts when they became due, but for loans from Harnisch Vigor. So under that test, they were not insolvent. The internal affairs doctrine on the choice of law, the internal affairs doctrine in comment C to the internal affairs doctrine provides that the law of the forum should apply where the corporation does all or most of its business in that forum and most of its shareholders, Harnisch Vigor, and has little contact with the state of incorporation. I think that obtains here on the allegations in the complaint. There was discussion about an attempt to argue the merits. Well, I'm arguing the law on the allegations in the complaint. We've stuck to the pleadings. We continue to stick to the pleadings.
Counsel, with regard to the pleadings, your argument is that it's an assigned claim because paragraph 3 uses the word assumed. I'm not sure that why assumed means assigned. Was there an actual assignment made by either operation of a court order or a contractual assignment that was
made
here?
Well, pursuant to the plan of reorganization, which is, in effect, a contract confirmed by the court on May 18th, the assets of Beloit Corporation, including this claim, were transferred to the Beloit Liquidating Trust on July 12th of 2001. So it is pursuant to that confirmed plan of reorganization, which is referred to as well in paragraph 3, the reference to the plan, et cetera. But we're sticking to the pleadings when we remind the court that, again, the shareholder of Beloit, there are two shareholders, Harnisch Vigor, 80%, and Mitsubishi. And throughout these pleadings, there are allegations over and over again, beginning in paragraph 1, but in paragraph 74, 75, 76, 77, 79, 89, 91, that in the conduct complained of, the defendants are acting in the interests of the shareholder. Well, that's what directors and officers are supposed to do. They have a fiduciary duty to the shareholder. On issue preclusion, the issue wasn't raised in the trial court. The issue wasn't raised in the Court of Appeals. It wasn't briefed in the Court of Appeals. It wasn't argued in the Court of Appeals. What's wrong with that? What's wrong with that is the court doesn't get the benefit of adversarial testing. And when the court doesn't get the benefit of adversarial testing, it perhaps misses things in the order, such as all defenses are preserved. Nothing in this order shall impair any defense. And statute of limitations, if you just open up 893, it's listed as one of the defenses that are, in fact, affirmative defenses that must be raised. The order that Judge Fine relied on, he didn't notice the language that order doesn't impair any defenses, such as this defense. Section 108A wasn't litigated, but in any event, the bankruptcy court preserved it, and the whole case then goes to the state courts along with any defense that anyone might raise. Trying to read my own handwriting, which gets very difficult.
I understand the problem. Me too. That's why I type.
Creditors, incidentally, get no benefit of 108A. They get no benefit of adverse domination. They don't get tolling. Again, the only people who benefit are the trustee and the debtor in possession. Creditors who then assign claims down the road don't get any tolling under 108A. Counsel mentioned that, well, if 108A applies, that's dispositive. You don't even get to 108A unless you also get through adverse domination. Again, the complaint alleges breach of fiduciary duty in 1996 when the contracts were entered into, when the company was supposedly insolvent, and that's when the breach was. Now, we have this allegation of adverse domination. And incidentally, adverse domination is an allegation that's absolutely inconsistent with the notion that we're talking here about negligent torts and that the negligence statute of limitations should come. But the fact that I got to talk about both of these isn't my fault. I'm not the one talking out of both sides of the issue. You know, if it's a negligent statute of limitations, then you don't have a cause of action because 180.0828, Regit versus Page, require intentional conduct. If it's a negligent statute of limitations, you also can't possibly have adverse domination. The total abandonment of the principal's interest required for adverse domination, which doctrine was rejected in Boyd. The court said the legislature should decide, and so on and so forth. But you can't have it both ways. If they aren't pleading intentional torts, there isn't a claim upon which relief may be granted, and this court can affirm Judge Dugan for that reason, because this court can affirm the trial court for any reason, even a reason that was never argued. Can't reverse him for any reason, but you can affirm him for any reason. That 6-year statute of limitations argument on top of it was waived. It wasn't raised in front of Judge Dugan. It's an effort to get beyond the fact that what we have here is a claim that's on its face is time barred. Some tolling is posited, adverse domination, hasn't been pled, is inconsistent with acting in the interest of the shareholders, is inconsistent with loaning $650 million. Adverse domination hasn't been adopted in Wisconsin. If it were to be adopted, this court would have to overrule Boyd. This court would have to decide that even though the court said the legislature should be doing that, this court would then say, well, the legislature hasn't done it. Let's take another look. Well, this court's entitled to do that, but I submit that adopting adverse domination would absolutely eviscerate any statute of limitations in a fiduciary duty case, and it shouldn't be done. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Lynn, and thank you, Mr. Bryan and Mr. Makeling, for your arguments on a very interesting case on issues that don't often come before this court. That concludes the hearing on 02-2035, Beloit Liquidating Trust versus Jeffrey T. Grade. The court will be in recess until 1:45 when it meets in the conference room. The students should remain here. They will be joined by other students, and Justice Prosser will be out momentarily. Everyone is invited to stay for the session with the students. We are not only in recess, we're adjourned for the February sitting.